Amen. You can be seated. And kids, before you head out, listen real quick, because we're just kind of set up. One of our kind of unique beliefs here, I think somewhat unique, is we love having the children in the worship, and we want as young as possible for them to learn that they belong with God's people, and they are here, and this is for them. So the kind of way we help orient them to that is we want them kindergarten to start out in here for the singing, and then from kindergarten and second grade, they go out to the library for story time, and we have a cycle, a loop there, so they'll be reading through Bible stories and reading through Pilgrim's Progress. Right now, we're in a cycle of reading through great lives of missionaries, so they can kind of orient to, you know, the Word is what we learn from and we feed on, and then there's great books that help us grow, and then there's great men and women in our family in the past. So kids, kindergarten through second, they'll start out in the library for story time, and to help them and our story time readers, when they're done with their story time, they're going to cross the way and go over to the playground. So parents, if you have kids in story time, you'll pick them up today at the playground. And for kids who are third grade and over, how we try and help you kind of orient in the back on the info card table is a kids bulletin. And in that kids bulletin is some questions and blanks for you to fill out and some activities. Now, Benjamin, actually, look in my bag. So I got my bag with me today, kids. And in my book bag, it is not filled with books. What is it filled with, Benjamin? Hold them up so they can see it. So, kids, you fill out your bulletin, and then afterwards, you come see me, and we'll check it. And once you get it all filled out, you can get one bag of the nerd clusters. And if you filled it out last week, I owe you. So I got a list of all the kids I owe. So make sure you get your bulletin, you can fill it out. Now, for the rest of you, we got some no fill in the blanks for your bulletins, and if you ask nicely, maybe I'll share the nerd clusters with you, but we're going through the book of Hebrews all fall for sure, and maybe into the spring, and we're in chapter 1, and the theme of the first several chapters of Hebrews is originally written as a sermon. And it's a sermon that's written to people who are in the midst of a very tumultuous time. So it's a moment of political instability. It's a moment of economic uncertainty. It's a moment of even physical danger. And it's a word that's given to them to meant to stabilize their soul, to give their soul an anchor where they can have this hope that will give them stability in the midst of just an incredibly tumultuous time. And the theme of the whole first section, chapters 1-4, is the need to listen to this word. That God has sent the definitive and final word, his son, and we need to pay attention. We need to listen. Don't harden your hearts, but hear. And all of you know that listening can be a challenge. You know, for our first child, when Maddie was born, with Cynthia and I were new parents, and you know, all parents, you know, there's just things you look back and you're like, oh man, you know, what a parenting fail. But for our first child, you know, Maddie, we didn't know when she was going through kind of like the terrible twos or just had, because there'd be times where we would like explicitly tell her to do something and then she'd look at us and smile and then do the exact opposite of what we said. And we'd say, like, do we just have a really strong-willed child who's just defiant? I mean, if she is, she's being defiant with such a bright smile. And so one day we were just kind of watching this interaction and she was utterly ignoring us. And we're thinking, is she just ignoring us? And I thought, I wonder if she can actually hear us. So I kind of went over the side and kind of started like, Maddie, and then nothing. Maddie, and it didn't respond. So we took her to the doctor and he informed us that her ears were like 90-something percent clogged with earwax. And it almost like had to get out this child jackhammer to get the earwax out. And we're like, ah, okay. It's not that she's just utterly defiant. She literally could not hear. Now we're moving into the teenage era, so we'll see if that excuse gets extended or if there's other reasons. But listening's hard. There's a funny story of Franklin Roosevelt who, at this time when he was president, there was a lot of socialite responsibilities that he had, and he hated them. and you'd have all these big kind of White House dinners, and then he'd have to stand as everybody was leaving, and there'd be a long procession line, and he'd have to shake everybody's hand and have like 30 seconds of pleasantries and small talk with everyone who had come, and he hated it. And he would run little experiments because he thought nobody was really listening to him anyway. And so on one particular occasion, like, he would smile and then mumble under his breath, "I killed my grandmother this morning." And then you would just watch the reactions from people. And, you know, people would say, "Oh, that's wonderful, Mr. President. You're doing such a great job. We're behind you every step of the way." His favorite was multiple people said, "Keep up the good work, sir." And there was only one attendee. It was the ambassador to Bulgaria, who once he heard, kind of smirked and leaned in and said, "I'm sure she deserved it, sir." And then he smirked and they instantly became friends. I mean, listening's just hard. And you know, in an hour where there's just so much noise, and then how do we listen? You know, you can have the radio on while you're driving, but are you listening? Are you listening to the people next to you? How do you cultivate an open ear? I was struck this week, even in my own Bible reading, I was reading through where Solomon, and you know, the classic thing where the Lord comes and asks Solomon, "What do you desire and I will give you?" And you know, we classically translate it, you know, "Give me wisdom." And then the Lord praises him, "Because you've asked for understanding and not the, you know, wealth or riches or the lives of your enemies, I will give you what you ask for and even more." But in the Hebrew, the word actually is, "Give me an open ear. Give me an ear to hear. Give me a wise heart who can listen." And that's one of the themes of this section, is not just this is who are you going to listen to, but then how do you learn to listen? And so last week we set off with verses 1 through 4 in chapter 1. And that's one brilliantly constructed, beautiful sentence that's meant to lift you up into the heavenlies. And then the writer is going to kind of riff off of this. And you get this section of seven, a string of quotations from the Old Testament, seven of them. And The Latin phrase for this rhetorical device is floragia. So you can have the flora. So it's almost like you take all of these quotations and then you create this bouquet of beauty that's meant to celebrate the subject. So we're going to kind of try and put these pieces together. It starts, because he's kind of riffing off verse 4, where he's exalted Jesus, and then he gives seven different kind of characteristics or aspects of who Jesus is. He's the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature. He upholds the universe by the words of his power. He has made purification for sins. He has sat down at the right hand of his majesty on high. He has become superior, better, greater than all of the angels, in whom he has inherited a more excellent name. So there's seven different kind of characteristics of who he is. And then amazingly, he then quotes seven different scriptures that are going to kind of unpack and unfold this description of Jesus. And you just look at this, like, this can't be a coincidence. And it would be so amazing if the seven different characteristics, if it mirrored perfectly the seven different scriptures. I don't think they do, but it'd be awesome if they did. Maybe they do. I couldn't find the connections this week. Maybe they're still there. But there's seven different scriptures. Now, what I want you to notice is he's going to then frame them around a couple rhetorical questions. So look in verse 5. "For to which of the angels did God ever say..." And then look at verse 13. "And to which of the angels has he ever said?" So the idea here now, he's unpacking the reality that Jesus is greater than the angels, these original messengers and servants of the old covenant, that he's spoken through his son and Jesus is greater. That's one of the themes running all throughout the book. Jesus is better, he's superior, he's greater. And here he's going to celebrate that the Son is superior to angels. And he also celebrates that the Son has been given this name. And then it takes you where it shows God speaking to the Son. This is what God has said to the Son. So before you can tune your ear to listen, because the Holy Spirit through the Word is speaking to you, but the first thing He wants you to hear is what God has actually said to the Son. And then amazing, it celebrates a name, and there's three names that God calls Jesus. He calls Him Son. And then in verse 8, He calls Him God. And then in verse 10, He calls Him Lord. So one of the things you'd be think through and unpack is God is calling Jesus Son, God, and Lord. And is there a development there? What's the significance of those names? But the way we'll unpack it, because I think the way they kind of fit together, is there's seven different quotations, and I think they go in pairs, and then the seventh is a summary. So the first two illustrate God's relationship to the Son. The second two illustrate the angel's relationship to the Son. And then the third pair illustrates like His kingdom and His reign. And then the last one sums it all up. So we're going to look at, this is celebrating the Son. And the Son is seated at the right hand. So first, let's just look and we'll celebrate the Son's seat. He's been enthroned. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my Son, today I have begotten you"? Or again, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son." So it's saying that Jesus is superior here because of his relationship to God the Father, and he's the Son, and the Son has been now elevated to a throne. And so this is quoting Psalm 2, and then 2 Samuel 7. So Psalm 2 is kind of the main passage, and that's what we read at the beginning. And Psalm 2 is an enthronement psalm. It's celebrating the fact that the Lord is going to take His anointed, His Messiah, His King, and He's going to set Him on the throne of the nations. And all the kings of the earth, they have two choices. They can either bow down to Him in reverence and find life and blessing, or they can rage against Him and try to usurp His throne and be destroyed. Two choices, but the Son, the King, He has taken His place on the throne. And so Psalm 2 is just such a beautiful, powerful psalm that's really worth internalizing, especially in days of political upheaval. Because what it does is it anchors you and orients you to the rule and reign of Christ the King. I mean, they were living in a dangerous world. And part of the paradox of Psalm 2 is that your ultimate safety can only be found in your joyful surrender. So safety comes from surrender. And what Psalms 2 is pointing to is because we don't need to read it and say, oh, well, why do the nations rage? Why are the kings in uproar? Like, I'm not a king. I'm not a president. I don't have really an authority, so this isn't a word to me. Because this is a word to anyone, you know, in one sense, as long as you have life, you have the ability to exercise agency over something. If you have life, then you have power. See, the theme of Psalm 2 is to whoever God grants power to, they have to use that power in a wise way. And the wise use of power is one that joyfully submits to the Son to kind of bring about His rule and His reign. So you think about your own life, and no matter what stage of life you're in, you have power over something. Even if it's just your internal thoughts or your own actions. You know, no one is without agency, even if you don't have a formal position of authority. You make decisions, you make choices that impact other people, even if you're a president, a parent, or a child. And then there's just kind of power that comes from just your presence, from your personality. Or maybe you do have a position where you can exercise authority. The question that Psalm 2 puts on us is, what will you do with that power? Will you use it to surrender and submit and bow the knee, or will you seek to dominate and domineer others? So Psalm 2 is a coronation psalm, and what's interesting is how often Psalm 2 is used in the New Testament. Like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all use Psalm 2 at Jesus' baptism. They all use Psalm 2 to explain for us Jesus' transfiguration. And then all throughout Acts, Peter and Paul both use Psalm 2 to explain what happened at the cross. Like, why is it that Jesus came to his own, but his own didn't receive him? What was Herod and Pilate and the Jewish leaders doing when they took the Lord's anointed and put him to death? They use it to explain the cross. And then all throughout Hebrews, it's using to explain how we should respond to him now. Like, he's been seated to the throne, so we should respond in wise adoration. He's seated on the throne, be wise, bow down. One of the interesting things about Psalm 2 is there's three different titles that's used in that psalm for the Son. He's called the Son, he's called the Lord's anointed, and he's called the King. And even just dipping my toe into Psalm 2 this week, start thinking, man, there's so much more here that's like taproots, waters that are fueling this section in Hebrews. So maybe there's a lot more connections than we can even see on the surface. But the first part, first two quotations, are orienting us to the Son, and the Son is now seated at God's right hand, ruling and reigning over the nations. Now look at the second block. The second block of quotations talk about his relationship to his servants, the Son's servants, which are angels. And the Psalms quoted here is Psalm 97 and Psalm 104. And all of this is saying this is what God has said to the Son. So he's told the Son, you are my Son. Today I've begotten you. And just kind of one little side note, kind of rabbit trail. This is celebrating the Son's enthronement. And so one way to misunderstand this passage is that Jesus wasn't the Son until he earned it and was exalted to the right hand. So this idea of today you are my Son, today I've begotten you, it's not begotten like biological creation. You know, in the ancient world, the concept of sonship was so much more than just like biology. And we even have some of it. But in the ancient world, you know, for a king, kind of the most important question for the realm is which one of his sons will then be seated on the throne. And so the son, so it's not, this isn't like a biological quote that he became the son at this point. It's more of a occupational. The son has taken his place as rule and reign right beside the father. So son is more like reflective, that he reflects the Father. He takes this position. But the Son's seat, now the Son's servants. And notice what it says about angels. It says, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. And of the angels, he said, he makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. Now, we kind of joke with the men's Bible study because there's so many little, you know, rabbit trails, side tangents we can go down. And I really don't know how long this sermon series will be because some of how much discipline we have not to go down these trails. But one very well-worn trail that might be worth exploring at some point is just the reality and nature of angels. Now, this whole chapter is a key passage for understanding angels. And to be honest, it's not really something I've thought a whole lot about. And even starting to dip my toe into this the past couple weeks, there's just such a rich history, both in the Christian tradition, but also the Jewish and Islamic tradition of thinking about angels. I was really surprised to see how much great theologians like Augustine, Anselm, Aquinas, Luther, Calvin had written on angels and how it had infused things, even popular level at the time, things like Dante and Milton and Paradise Lost. And it was intriguing because angels were kind of at the top of people's mind in their consciousness up until about the 1800s. And then there's a pretty big drop off. Like about 1800, it seems that we start getting really embarrassed by angels. And think, well, you know, once the scientific method becomes the dominant way where we acquire knowledge, so in order for something to be true, it must be observable, repeatable, and verifiable, and anything that doesn't fall into that category just must not exist. So some of the great kind of liberal theologians of the 1800s were very embarrassed by these things. So like Schleiermacher said that this is in the realm of myth. You know, Rudolf Bultmann from the 1950s said the whole goal was to demythologize, that these were just the remnants of primitive people who didn't understand the ways of the world. So, you know, they would hear thunder and think that, oh, that's angels bowling. I just know you go back and you read people like Aquinas, that's not what they thought angels were. And then, but in the 20th century, angels do start to make a comeback. They start to enter into kind of the popular consciousness. But it's not something I've thought a whole lot about. In fact, the past week, Cynthia and I do a workout class at our gym, and it's always at noon on Wednesday. And she showed up, and I was there, and I was just kind of staring off into outer space. And she's like, hello, you know, Earth to Ben. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I spent all morning diving into what Jonathan Edwards talks in his miscellanies about angels, and I'm just having my mind blown. And so anyway, it would be a side trail that's worth going down. So you think, all right, what was kind of common in this time? You know, at this time, at least classic Jewish thought, is that there were four angels. They called the angels of the presence, Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, and Phanuel. And they stood at the four corners of God's throne. And their job was to move God's throne all throughout his palace, which is the heavens. And you may have heard of at least three of those, Michael, Gabriel, Raphael. They were considered three of the seven archangels, the highest angels. And their responsibility, they have different territories. And their responsibility was to bring both the prayers of the saints into God's presence, but then also hear reports from the other angels who would bring them reports. So that's all kind of going on in the first century. So it's interesting to think, huh? Is the author doing something unique where now we have Jesus at the right hand, so we don't need those angels and other ministering spirits? Like, what is their role? And one of the things you see, even just looking at the verses, that this is the first good thing that the writer of Hebrews wants to celebrate, that in Jesus we have something better. And he says, there has been a man who's now been elevated higher than the angels. But you can look, who are they? It says, first, they're called to worship him when the firstborn comes into the world. Now, the question is that at his birth, when all the angels and the heavenly host sang? Is that at the exaltation when he comes into heaven? One of the things that was kind of blowing my mind reading Jonathan Edwards thought that the angels did not get kind of confirmed into their holiness until the exaltation of Christ. So there was still a chance that they could fall before them. And the actual throne that he took was originally, or at one point Lucifer was on. Anyway, it was just, I don't know, but it's worth reading more about. So what are they doing? And here it says that they're swift, they're fervent, they're powerful messengers who burn with love and devotion for the triune God. Notice he makes his angels, they're like winds, they swift, they move. And then his ministers are a flame of fire, so they burn. So you can think of images of God's presence and fire. And even when Adam and Eve are cast out of the garden, there's one of the seraphim, the station, and he has this burning sword moving in every direction. So they're inflamed. And then notice in verse 14, are they not all, talking about angels, ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? So their job is to minister and serve those people who are receiving us, receiving salvation. Interesting kind of words in the Greek here. Are they not all ministering spirits? That word is a word you could translate literally, say liturgy. Are they not all liturgical? That's the same word for leading in the worship of the priest as they lead the people in their worship. Are they not liturgical spirits sent out to serve? That's where we get deacon, deaconos. Aren't they sent out to deacon to serve the people who inherit salvation? So their top priority is worship. They're oriented to worship. But then you think about angels, and one of the things, you know, we use in popular context and talk about, you know, so-and-so is like an angel. There's movies like Angels Are in the Outfield. So you think, all right, what does it mean to be like an angel? So if you want to be angel-like, you know, one of the things you do is, do you quickly and eagerly and joyfully do the will of the King? That's why they exist. They're eager, willing, joyful servants of Christ. And every time we pray the Lord's Prayer, may your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, we're asking to make us more like the angels who always eagerly do the will of the Lord. So it's worth thinking, how much like an angel are you? Do you joyfully, quickly, do his will. Priority of worship and celebration of who he is. So these are the son's servants. And this next little cycle, notice the son's service. So what's it like to be in his service? Who is this king like? It says, but of the son, he says, so this is still God. And then God is talking to the son. And he says, your throne, O God. So this is one of the things that caused the early church kind of like smoke to come out of their ears. Wait, God the Father is talking to the Son, and God is calling him God. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of your uprighteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, so your God, but your God, but then your God has now taken you and anointed you with the oil of gladness. And so here's God the Father still speaking to the Son, but he says, and you, Lord, so the Lord is calling the other one Lord. You, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment, like a robe. You will roll them up like a garment. They will be changed, but you are the same, and your years have no end. So some of the imagery here, notice the symbol of his authority. He's given this scepter, and the scepter is a symbol of his authority and reign. The reason for his authority is because what he loves and what he hates. You love righteousness, you hate wickedness. And then the result is that he gets anointed, this oil gets poured on him. He becomes the anointed one, the Mashiach, the Messiah. And what that oil is the oil of gladness. So the result of his reign is this overflowing, beautiful fragrance of joy. And so there's two things you can kind of notice about his being in his service. There's an eternal component. Do you notice how it's framed up? The very first line of verse 8, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. So your throne, your rule, your reign, your administration will not be on yearly cycles. Your administration is eternal. But not just your administration, your person. Notice, but you, in verse 12, are the same, and your years have no end. So one thing he's trying to do, he's trying to encourage them that you're a part of this kingdom that is not going to fall by the wayside of time. You know, we say, like, what are the only inevitables in life? It's death and taxes. Or you think about, like, in sports, there's a cliche that it's something like father time always wins, or that's not the cliche. What you probably heard it before, but like father time always wins or something. Anyway, you can't be father time. It means everybody is always getting older. And, you know, all good things, we all know this, all good things, what? They must come to an end. And here's the thing, well, actually, there is one really good thing that will not end, his throne, his reign, and then his person. So it's eternal, it's stable. But then just notice the emotional language. It's because you have loved what's righteous, you have hated wickedness, and then you get poured out this oil of joy. And so the result of his reign is this overflowing joy or gladness. I think it's worth reminding ourselves, especially in difficult times, because you can think that the mark of a Christian is to slouch or have a long face. A country pastor, when I was a kid, used to say something like, you know, some of you have the Lord's joy so, like, buried so down deep in your heart that he would have some funny way of saying it never comes out. The idea is that he loves righteousness, he hates Christ. So this idea of fussy Christians, you know, tisking Christians who, you know, keep off my grass kind of Christians. Says this is not who we serve, one who's overflowing with the oil of gladness. But just as Psalm 2 is a victory psalm, and in unstable times, it's worth really thinking about. What's fascinating is this psalm is Psalm 45, and Psalm 45 is a marriage psalm. It's a celebration psalm. It's a psalm that's meant to celebrate a king's wedding. And you read through Psalm 45, and it's almost like it's overwhelming with sights and sounds and smells that are meant to bring delight. And so this is a psalm that's really worth asking. You know, real joy comes from the emotions. He loved righteousness. He hated wickedness. He was filled with joy. And one of the great challenges in life is to have our joys become his joys, or his joys be our joys. So it's worth asking, this morning you come in with, you're filled with loves. You're filled with things you hate. You're filled. Are you filled with joy? Do your loves match his love? Is it a love for righteousness? Hate wickedness, overflowing with joy. I was reading Augustine, St. Augustine, his sermon on Psalm 45. He says, when he's about to start preaching it, he says, "We have joyfully sung this psalm with you." So part they were, you know, well, most of the history of the church has been psalm singing. So they would sing the psalms. Those were the hymnal, the worship book of the church. So they'd sung Psalm 45. And he says, "We have joyfully sung this psalm with you, and now I beg you to study it carefully with me. It's a song about a sacred marriage. It's a song about a bridegroom and his bride. It's a song about a king and his people. It's a song about a Savior and those he has saved. So let us rejoice at his marriage, and let us be among the people for whom this marriage is made. You who are invited to the wedding, you are one of the invited guests, and you yourself are the bride. For his church is his bride, and this sings a song of our bridegroom." So as we hear the song, he's overflowing with the oil of gladness. This is a summons for his people to come into his presence, to come and sing and celebrate. So we began thinking about listening is hard. But it really is hard. Some people are easier to listen to than others. And often it depends on the motivation of your own heart. Like, do you want to hear what they have to say? And the whole first part of Hebrews chapter 1 is meant to encourage you encourage you and say, we have one who's coming to speak to us who is worthy. Just like Peter says, where shall we go? You have the words of life. He brings the words of life. So ask the Lord to help you. Take a moment as we transition to communion. What I want to do at this time is just give you a moment, some space where you can examine your own heart. And just ask, how true is this psalm for your own heart? How much do your loves match up with his loves? Your hates or dislikes match up with his? What are you marked by joy? Do you need more of his joy, the fruit of his spirit of joy? So take a moment and examine your own heart this morning. And as you continue to look in, one of the images that communion is it's a regular reminder of the feast of the Lamb, the wedding feast of the Lamb. So it's like a little foretaste, a little appetizer that says, wait, your best days are still ahead. And so here at Trinity, we come to the table every single week. We'll have four stations. There'll be one in the back that's gluten-free. And this is for all baptized believers who come and let this week as you come, you'll take the cracker, you'll dip, and let it be a physical, tangible reminder for your senses that the wedding feast of the Lamb is still to come. So once the servers are in place, you come.